Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Dave's Good Vibration Station with Dave Cohen, right here on LA Talk Radio.
As you know, this is the show where we talk about anything and everything to raise your vibration. Well, we got the high vibrations here in the Good Vibration Studio. You've just tuned in. I'm your host, Davey. And we have a very, very special show lined up for you guys today. As you know, this is the show where we talk about anything and everything to raise your vibration. Now, what do we mean by this, right? We're all constantly, moment by moment, reacting, interacting with our surroundings, right? But little do we know that every single one of these interactions, every single subconscious or very conscious thought, action, movement is all triggered by a response in your brain. It's a vibration, right? You know what I'm saying? That's like a neuron, synapse, consciousness. And what you think, what you feel is emitting a certain frequency. It's like a radio dial, just like you've tuned into the vibration station, right? So, how do we tune ourselves to be the wholeness, the greatness? We listen to people like our guest today. I'd like to introduce someone very, very special. He is Bruce Rawls. How we doing, my friend?
Great, Dave. Thanks brother. For having me on your show. Really appreciate it.
My brother, man. Now, let me tell you guys something, a little bit about Bruce. If you hadn't heard of him before, Bruce Rawls is a mystical explorer, geometric artist, and researcher, author, and illustrator of two books, one being the Sacred Geometry Design Sourcebook, Universal Dimensional Patterns, and number two, the Geometry Code, Universal Symbolic Mirrors of Natural Laws Within Us, Friendly Reminders of Inclusion to Forgive the Dreamer of Separation. I love it, man. I absolutely love it. Collaborating with Mika Feinberg of Light Source, he developed a companion screensaver with dynamic imagery that complements his second book, The Geometry Code. His geometrically inspired interplanetary artwork has been exhibited in several states, plus Switzerland, Austria, and Asia. He's a student of non-dual metaphysics, a WordPress web designer, developer, and editor/webmaster. You might have heard of many of the websites he's worked on, such as geometrycode.com, acimblog.com, brucerawls.com, and wpwebdesigns.com. You'll get to know a little bit later in the show from Bruce today. He enjoys numerous interests and lives with his wife and two cats south of Denver, Colorado. Welcome, Bruce, to the Vibration Station. It's a pleasure to have you here, my friend.
Thank you so much, and what a build-up. I'm not sure how special, but I'll have fun sharing it. And you already got me in a very fun mood just with your intro, so appreciate that.
Love it, man. Love it. Well, that's what it's all about, Bruce, is having fun and having a good time, raising the vibration, right? That's something that,
you betcha,
that I'm passionate about, and why I brought you on the show today, I know that you're passionate about it as well. You've dedicated your whole life to raising people's vibration. Something that I wanted to get into about, you know, speaking about vibration, speaking about sacred geometry. We are all, and I'm not telling this to Bruce. This is something that, if anything, I would learn from Bruce. But this is a little preface for the listeners. We're all, if you've been listening to the Vibration Station, you already know this, in a, basically a matrix, right? This quantum reality, the cells of our body are all vibrating molecules that all have geometrical patterns, right? Everything, the universe, from our molecules to the galaxies to the very instruments of, you know, planetary workings. It's all a product of alignment, right? Alignment represented through geometry, also known as sacred geometry. Bruce, if you don't mind, can you tell us a little bit about the mysticism of Plato, right? Kind of Platonic solids, mm-hmm. having to do with the sacred geometry, and could just kind of expand on that. Just give us a background, right, of what this sacred geometry thing is about. What these solids, the Platonic solids, what's going on here?
Okay, we'll do. And I'm going to do a slight contextual introduction.
Please.
Hopefully I won't take more than a few minutes of your time.
We got all the time in the world, Bruce.
Okay. Well, how I got into all this stuff, was I credit my parents, both of them, for a tremendous amount of the inspiration and influence in what kind of got me into this whole level of inquiry.
That's awesome.
To start off, from day one, my mom was very interested in things out of the ordinary, and I think that was largely due to the fact that when she was a teenager on Catalina Island, not far from probably where you're broadcasting this,
absolutely,
she was at her grandmother's house. As a teenager on a beach where she with a whole bunch of people, and she saw all the heads turning at once when a fleet of craft moved very, very fast. Wow. Overhead and made an abrupt right angle turn in tandem and disappeared.
Wow.
And she said if she was hallucinating, and she's told me this story many times, if she was hallucinating, it was a mass hallucination, because every head on the beach turned, you know, lockstep, watching these however many there were craft, you know, just mock whatever.
Absolutely.
Right angle, 90-degree turn.
Wow.
And then poof, gone kind of thing. And so that kind of upset her, you know, belief systems a little bit, needless to say. And she became, you know, interested in mystical studies, paranormal, particularly UFO studies. And that, I think, after sort of the primary child rearing years were over for her, and I was in high school, and my younger brother, who also has a popular blog, a little
awesome
plug in from brother Jim.
Cool. What's the name of the blog?
It's a very different subject. It's called survivalblog.com.
Very cool. Very cool. Make sure to check it out.
Yeah. Anyway, about this time in my mom's life, started realizing, well, okay, I kind of got this child rearing mostly out of the way. You know, there's still a few years left to do, but mostly out of the way. And so I think her thoughts turned to like, okay, now what are we here for? And then that's kind of led her from, you know, conventional religion to a lot of the just basically what you'd call metaphysical inquiries. And so along with her, I was in my high school years and sort of did the spiritual buffet line, metaphysical smorgasbord kind of perusal of things.
Yes, yes.
And studied and read a whole bunch of different stuff. And two books that she threw in front of me as part of this inquiry were a book by Peter Tompkins called Secrets of the Great Pyramid.
Wow.
And we had just heard, or maybe it was just before or after that, heard a lecture by a fellow named Pat Flanagan, who had been working with models of the pyramid and charging gold-clad plates with pyramid energy, which he basically figured out a way by, you know, infusing a metal plate. And I bought one of these and was experimenting with it. And then I built and ended up building a scale model of the Great Pyramid in our backyard and meditated in it and did all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
And
we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah. What's that?
We'll talk about that a little bit later.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
With the more in-depth, I want to hear about that.
Yeah. And then, so that was the Tompkins book, The Secrets of the Great Pyramid, had a whole chapter devoted to this new thing that I hadn't heard of before called the golden ratio, or the phi proportion.
Yes.
Or the sacred cut, or the extreme and mean ratio. It goes by a number of different names.
Indeed.
But it's basically a proportion that divides any length into two unequal segments that have the property where if you take the large portion of what you've divided and compare that to the small portion, it's the same ratio, the same proportion as the whole, the sum of the two divided by the large portion.
Wow.
And if you do the math on that, and that was about the time of in my schooling when I was learning the quadratic formula, you plunk in the numbers to that, and you can look that up on Google and wherever.
Absolutely.
And you'll find that that gives you an exact value of the golden ratio of 1 plus the square root of 5 all divided by 2.
Wow.
Which if you take it out to, well, at least three significant places, it's 1.618. Actually, it's 1.618033988874, and it goes on ad infinitum. But that's what's called the golden ratio. And
yes.
I thought, well, that's kind of interesting because it's basically a metaphor for the principle of interconnectedness,
exactly.
If you think about it. And
exactly.
That's why it shows up in places like pentagrams and spirals and a mathematical series that's credited to a fellow named Fibonacci, Leonardo
da
Pisa, whose nickname was Fibonacci.
Yes.
And go ahead.
Oh no! I was saying yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
The Fibonacci sequence. That's another name. There's like
100
names for it. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Exactly. And so, and if you take that series, which is real simple, it's a very, very simple series. It starts with one and one, or unity and unity, if you want to think of it metaphysically, metaphorically, symbolically.
Yeah.
And the sum of each. The next new number in that series is the sum of the previous two numbers. So 1 and 1 make 2, 1 and 2 make 3, 2 and 3 make 5, 3 and 5 make 8, 5 and 8 make 13, and then you get to 21 and 34 and 55 and 89 and 144, and it just keeps going and going and going ad infinitum.
Yes.
Well, you might say, well, so what's the big deal about the Fibonacci series? Well, it shows up over and over and over again in art and nature and architecture and the Platonic solids, which we'll talk about in a moment.
Yes.
But this chapter in the Tompkins book very much intrigued me, and I thought, well, that's pretty amazing that the architects of this structure, unless it was an incredible coincidence, and there's so many things in the Great Pyramid that it would be hard to attribute that to coincidence.
Absolutely, there's no way that one's coincidence. No.
Well, I kind of was led to believe there may have been some intention behind that.
Indeed,
and the way that proportion shows up in what's called the Great Pyramid, also known as the Cheops Pyramid, the Khufu Pyramid, but I think that's kind of akin to calling the White House the Bush House or the Obama House. You know, they may have hung out there and spent some time there, but it's probably best to kind of give the more all-encompassing names.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So anyway, so the way that shows up in that particular structure, if you imagine a four-sided pyramid, with a square base and then four triangular sides, the triangles aren't exactly equilateral triangles. They're just a little bit different from that. And the way that the mathematics works, and this is good to two or three decimal places, is if you take a midpoint of each of those triangular faces on the base and then run it up, vertically, but at an angle through the middle of the face to the peak or the apex of the pyramid, that line that goes from the middle of each of the bases up to the top is called the apothem.
Okay.
And that's just a geometric term for when you take a triangle and then cut it in half, and that right-angled line goes up to the top of any isosceles triangle.
Wow.
So the ratio of the apothem to one half of that base length is, drum roll please, the golden ratio. Well, that's pretty cool.
Does
that ratio show up in the Great Pyramid, but also the pi proportion, which is basically if you take the ratio of the circumference of the pyramid. Imagine looking down on the pyramid from an aerial view,
okay, and
you're going to see a square with the, you know, essentially diagonals, you know.
Yes, like facing
from,
off of
from
it,
opposite corner to opposite corner.
Yes, yes.
And if you imagine then a circle that was superimposed over that square that had the same circumference as the same identical to the perimeter.
Right.
So in other words, it's what's the classic geometric term of called squaring the circle, and that's
okay.
it's been a geometrical conundrum and puzzle for millennia, but it was essentially solved in the Great Pyramid.
Wow.
Architecturally by taking the ratio of the altitude of the pyramid.
Okay.
And then, so in other words, that's the same as the distance to that imaginary circle, if you will, that has the same exact numerical value as the four sides added up together.
Right, right, right.
That is a 1:2 pi ratio, which is the same as a hemisphere or a circle with its radius.
Wow.
And so that's why most likely one of the folks who visited the Great Pyramid years ago, which was documented in the Tompkins book, was a Mr. Mercator. And if anybody studied map making or just goes online and Googles Mercator, you'll see that that's one of the more famous cartographic projections or a map maker's projection of showing how you can take a spherical object, or actually it's a spheroid because it's slightly flattened at the poles, which interestingly enough, the Great Pyramid goes into that as well.
Wow.
It encodes that proportion.
It's amazing.
Because of the latitude on which it's placed is actually slightly off the 30-degree parallel above the equator. But if you take into account the flattening of the poles, it's exactly in the 30th parallel above the equator. But anyway, and the Tompkins book goes into all this stuff, and it was just fascinating. And I thought, well, that's pretty amazing. So all this geometrical insight and wisdom was encoded in this structure that's at least 4,000 or 5,000 years old.
Absolutely.
And if John Anthony West and some of his colleagues, like Robert Schock, who we got to meet when we were there in 1992 in front of the Giza complex, sitting at the Mennen House Hotel lawn, and he just happened to be there.
That's
when
amazing.
We were on a tour with Greg Braden there.
I was reading that in your bio. I wanted to ask you a few questions about that as we got into the show. Sorry, please go on.
Oh yeah. Well, anyway, so thanks for that. What was amazing is John Anthony West, who was sort of a rogue Egyptologist, basically, he kind of bucks the common view that dynastic Egypt was basically the beginning and the flowering of their culture. And West's hypothesis is, well, maybe kind of like Cheops and Khufu.
Right, right.
Maybe they were kind of Johnny-come-latelys, and there were folks there that might have been there a bit before that.
Yes.
And to corroborate that, what West did was kind of sneaky and clever, is he took a picture of the Sphinx. Oh, the hindquarters in particular, where it was super heavily eroded, and he masked it off in such a way that you couldn't really tell what it was. It just looked like some arbitrary architectural detail on some building or something, you know.
Right, right.
And he gave it to a geologist named Robert Schock. And what Schock is his specialty, I mean, he's a world-renowned geologist whose specialty is in water erosion.
Oh, okay.
The causes and the archaeology and the history and the geologic timeline precedent for those kind of phenomena.
Right.
Well, so he gave this sneakily masked off picture of the Sphinx handed it to Schock and said, "So what you think was the cause of this particular wearing, or erosion or whatever?" And he said, "Oh, without a doubt, water erosion."
Okay.
And he said, "Many millennia of water erosion, in fact,
yes,
would be necessary to account for this amount of erosion."
Yes. Yes.
Well, it turns out, and then he ripped off the masking, and they all kind of both shocked, looked at him like, "What?
Wow, <I'm> tricked." That's funny.
Because the contemporary view is, well, the Sphinx is about the same age as the pyramid, which is also believed to be 4,000 or 5,000 years old,
right?
And in that ballpark, and Schock said, "Well, there hasn't been that kind of rainfall and water erosion for many, many millennia."
There's no way. There's no
So there's no way it could have been built in the time frame that it's generally believed.
And you know what? Oh, sorry. Please.
Oh, go ahead. No, yeah, that was pretty much the end of the thought. Yeah.
No, that's amazing, Bruce. And you know, you bring up a really great point. In many books I've read, you know, many books of, you know, people that have channeled entities and have said that there's, you know, been great floods and then other things, and you know, just like there's this theory, and I like to believe it as something that's coming to the common understanding. Is that there was a great flood. There was a massive flood, and we could almost consider this. We've heard of Atlantis, right? Uh-huh. And tell me if I'm on the right track, Bruce. We've heard of Atlantis, and we've kind of always thought of Atlantis being, you know, this, oh, mystical city of the past and this underwater city, and da-da-da, you know. Well, I from my understanding, is Atlantis is our kind of perception of the humans that were still somewhat advanced, still had a higher activated consciousness, higher more strands DNA. They were maybe working. We were all working together with these. You know, like Galactic Federation of Light and stuff like that, you know, kind of getting into that area. And then there was this like big war or whatever. And then there was this big flood. And then after the flood, you know, things settled out. And then, you know, the organisms came, and then the dinosaurs and blah, blah, blah. Are you familiar with this, Bruce?
Yeah, I am. And what I try to stick to for the most part, you know, having grown up in a very scientific community, I try to stick to mostly what, you know, it appears to be factual.
Yes.
But what I found in which actually kind of brings me to the second part of the to weave back a little bit to the introduction and perhaps finish that off of,
yes,
the,
yes,
of my,
yes,
my sort of historical precedent and interest in the subject.
Absolutely.
So the Great Pyramid was definitely a huge influence, and after almost going there in 73 with a musician from Los Angeles named Paul Beaver, who's no longer with us, but I'd gotten a passport and everything and arranged to take a year off of my college to go there and record electronic music in the Great Pyramid. And
that's going. Oh, yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, we got to tell people about that a little bit
well,
more.
Well, that trip never that's awesome. Happened because in 73 the Middle East hostilities were at a fever peak there, and so I ended up getting a pilot's license and doing a few other things that year. But
cool.
I did go 19 years later in the fall of 92 with Greg Braden and my mom.
That's amazing.
Weaving that story, and there's 21 of us, another Fibonacci number, of course. that were yes, in what's called the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, and we were having, you know, just amazing experiences. I remember, you know, doing what's called toning and finding the resonant frequency of this granite box that's, I think, erroneously called a sarcophagus, it was like, and hearing that echo inside this chamber whose proportions are 2, 4, and the square root of 5.
Wow.
Any numbers sound familiar there?
The Fibonacci, right? We're doing Fibonacci sequence, yeah.
Exactly. And then going up and down what's this diagonal corbelled passageway called the Grand Gallery, and hearing this echo, but it sounded like a 1,000-voice choir,
wow,
you know, singing through me. And
right,
what's neat is I've discovered that other people, including our own group there, but other people outside of that have had a similar experience.
Wow.
And I've learned that it's not necessary to have a specific structure to do that, which is where I become sort of a heretic or sacrilegious, I guess, even in the sacred geometry circles. Because I think the tools and the mechanisms can be useful, but when we try to make them special or unique or a requirement for a mental state, I think is where we get into trouble. Because
yes,
I think we have the ability within our minds to make choices regardless of the specific externals that seem to be happening. So anyway, that's an aside that we can expand
absolutely
tremendously in a later conversation. But
yes.
But I'll just finish the other book that my mom, about the same era, ran across and gave me a copy of, was called This Living Earth by David Cavagnaro. And in that book, there was just a fairly brief mention, not even a chapter, but just a, you know, a page or so about the golden ratio. And it was talking about fiddle ferns and chambered nautilus shells and
wow,
the spiral whirlpools that, you know, you notice when you lift the plug out of the drain, or look at a satellite photo of a hurricane, or the Milky Way galaxy, or just so many different things. Follow these geometric archetypes.
A pine cone, you know, the way a tree grows, like everything, you know.
Exactly. If you Google Fibonacci series and golden ratio spirals, you will find just tons and tons of things. I mean, even rabbit populations follow a Fibonacci pattern.
And correct me if I'm wrong. Don't bird flight patterns as well? Don't they follow some sort of?
No doubt. I mean, I'm not familiar with that particular instance, but there's just so many examples where the golden ratio comes up in everything from stock market analysis to the molecular biology and well, just for example, the cross section of the DNA molecule.
Yes.
I mean, I suspect most of your listeners would be, even if begrudgingly, say, well, yeah, if you had to pick a molecule that represents what we call life, that would probably be a pretty good candidate, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, even if you're more by the books and not necessarily indulging into the more spiritual, energetic kind of quantum mechanics of life, right, I think we could all still agree that the essence of a DNA molecule could right? Is that what we're dealing with here?
Yeah. So, like as you're saying, you know, even if you don't have one of your cool T-shirts, which I think are really a little plug for your little T-shirt business
and
elegant designs, by the way. But even if you don't have a Watson and Crick T-shirt, let's say, you know, who were the ones who were credited with discovering the DNA.
Yes.
I think it's fascinating that the DNA molecule, which is this double helix, this double spiral with the lattice, you know, essentially a curving ladder that wraps its way down. I'm sure you've probably seen it. Most of your listeners probably can picture that.
Absolutely. Just the DNA spiral, yes.
Exactly. It's basically, if you turn it on end and look down the barrel of this thing, it's the outline of it is what's called a decagon, which is basically a 10-sided shape, which is really nothing more than two pentagons. And the pentagon, if you draw the lines in between any regular pentagon or ones with all the equal sides and equal angles, you will discover that the ratio of all those pieces that are made of by creating that five-pointed star or pentagram are related to each other by this golden ratio proportion. In fact, by powers of the golden ratio proportion. So the smallest piece, if you arbitrarily make that one unit, the next larger size will be phi or phi, or sometimes it's the Greek letter tau is used, but it's basically a symbol representing the golden ratio.
Wow.
So it's basically about 1.618 times as big as that smallest piece.
Wow.
And the next larger piece will be the sum of those two, which just happens to be phi squared, which is really gets to that where that quadratic formula comes in, is 1 plus phi equals phi squared.
Yes.
Or metaphorically, unity plus this principle of interconnectedness, as I like to think of it.
Yes.
Integrated, added together, becomes that principle raised to another dimension, or squared, if you will.
It's life, yes. It's three-dimensional life, right?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So that those two books that my mother gave me kind of got me, you know, hurled headlong in my adolescent years into metaphysics. And so that's what ended up being a pivotal experience years later, when Greg Braden, who was basically studying under Drunvalo Melchizedek,
yes,
some of your listeners might have heard of.
Yes, indeed.
And in fact, Greg actually ended up buying Drunvalo's house near Taos, New Mexico.
That's funny.
And part of the, you know, the legacy of that heritage was a long line of interest in things geometric and proportional and that sort of thing. So that was in 91, I think, that I met Greg in my mom's living room, and before he became popular and was giving lectures all over the world.
Yes.
And we ended up going with Greg to Egypt in the fall of 92 and just had an amazing and transformative experience. And that really hurled me back into what's known as sacred geometry.
Wow.
And along the same time, the other part that I wanted to wrap up, again, this introduction is sort of meandering into other subjects.
No. This is perfect. This is exactly the information we need to know. This is
okay. All right. Well, I always have fun sharing because I think anybody can relate to it in terms of the overall principles and what the other half of the parental influence that I found really helpful was my dad was a supervisor on a cyclotron or a cyclograph actually at Lawrence Livermore Labs where I grew up in Northern California.
Very cool.
And so I heard terms around the dinner table like isotopes and deuterium and stuff like that.
Yes.
And I thought everybody knew what those were, right? And I learned later on that no, that's normal, you know, kid right. dinner table conversation.
Right. That's funny.
But the interest, so I kind of by osmosis kind of got a lot of physics jargon and interest
that's really
going.
Cool.
And so when the idea of, well, what does the physics really lead to? Mm. You know, that kind of blended in with my mom's metaphysical inquiry,
right.
Sort of like, well, how do these all fit together?
Right.
And when years later, it went off to, from a few years later from my high school years, went off to college and was taking the theoretical physics that we had as part of my engineering curriculum.
Wow.
And, you know, learned some of the things like the wave particle duality, for example, you know, that an electron can either behave as a wave or a particle,
yes,
depending on one's expectations.
Wow, yes.
Now that I think was, it's sort of like how we build houses, assuming we try to make the ground flat.
Right.
You know, when the caterpillar tractor rolls into a new housing development, they try to level off each pad, make it nice and flat.
Exactly.
We're doing this on a sphere, right?
Yes, absolutely.
If we back out on our Google map far enough, you're going to see this sort of circular object. It's like, well, why are we making this square? Well, obviously, to a first approximation, you know, you do probably want a flat foundation.
Yes.
But it's the same kind of thing as we all the stuff that totally freaked out the likes of Bohr and Planck and Heisenberg and Einstein and those folks.
Yes.
When quantum mechanics was and quantum theory was birthed, we conveniently forget. I mean, we use the theories in semiconductors and the technology that we're communicating on right now, and so much more is all based on that theory.
Exactly.
And you know, we wouldn't be able to function in our quote unquote modern world without it.
Absolutely.
But in terms of the really thinking about what the implications of it, well, that's where we stop short and say, I don't think I'll go there.
Yes. Yes, totally.
Because the implications are identical, if you extrapolate anyway, I think, to what the mystics have been saying for millennia, which is basically there's an intrinsic oneness and there is a principle. And this is what got me into Hermetic philosophy, which I started studying along with my mother's metaphysical interests in the early 70s. And was exposed to a book called The Kabbalion. And not to be confused with the Kabbalah, which obviously has, you know, other metaphysical and symbolic connections.
Of course.
But there's a book called The Kybalion, or Kybalion, that was written by the Three Initiates, by Yogi Publication Society in 1912. So it's just a little over 100 years old. And that book talks about seven hermetic laws that are universal laws. And that was really what was fueling my interest all along and continues to do to this day.
Yes.
Is it was what's the same? What doesn't change? And I think that's why I was drawn so much to mathematics, because, you know, you can go to Alpha Centauri or presumably, you know, the farthest galaxy you can imagine and, you know, land your spacecraft there and hopefully find a breathable atmosphere on some planet and you know, do the math on
absolutely
on a triangle and come up with the same laws of trigonometry or the same platonic solids or the same, you know, that, laws of physics, that, presumably.
That right there is amazing. I mean, yeah. that thought in itself is so powerful, you know, to think that here where we stand in our DNA, in our down to what creates the very essence of who we are is, you know, physical and non-physical, is based off of the same quantum mechanics, the same... I mean, physics, quantum and traditional, you know, physics is like, right, it's the right. same, it's the same basics. It's the same platform, whether you're on exactly planet Earth or in some, you know, Earth-like planet, you know, 10 trillion light years away. It's, there, hopefully, and I mean, this is the... Not hopefully, is the conclusion that we've come to, you know, is that it is the same, it is the same physics. Bruce, yeah. one thing that I wanted to talk with you about, which I just think is so cool, is you were mentioning the vibration, the resonance in these pyramids. I've had my own personal experience with you know, harmonies and vibrational resonance and doing, like, you know, singing bowls and, you know, sound healings and stuff. And I totally resonate with that feeling when you're talking about, you know, it literally goes through you, to you and through you. Like, these, like, it becomes you.
Exactly.
I wanted to talk more on how we can use these types of tools that have been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years to affect the geometry of our bodies, of our cells. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And that's actually something that I think I approach in a sort of more of a roundabout way,
yes,
rather than a more direct way. In fact, about a decade ago, I was asked to give a series of presentations at a sacred geometry conference in Sedona. And very one of the cool presenters there had an elaborate set of geometrical archetypes, both two and three dimensional. And she had mapped out, you know, her correlations to a whole bunch of different attitudes and thoughts and feelings and emotions. And
yes,
and I have no idea if there's any validity to that or not.
Right.
I do, however, think that we can actually simplify it tremendously, which I think will tie into that the Kabbalion book, which really ties into what you were just talking about, which is the third law of which is the law of vibration.
Yes.
The first and second laws, I think, are at least as important. And I think that if you actually get the first one, the rest kind of fall into place.
Yes. What is the first one?
The first of these seven hermetic laws is the law of mentalism, which states that all is mind, everything is mental.
Yes.
And I think what that really tells us is that we may or may not be able to change the particulars of our space-time hologram, if you will,
yes,
that we find ourselves in. Yes. And I use the word hologram very intentionally because I think movies like The Matrix and Inception and there's a whole bunch of them out there now that essentially use the metaphor of, you know, the theatrics of the mind and dreaming and so many of those wonderful metaphors, you know, like Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and, you know, we're merely players that have their entrances and exits. And
yes.
I think the physical world, and I think that's where the physics for me became passionate quest to understand the metaphysics because of my father's and mother's interest and you know, the amalgam of those two, I just kind of took and ran with it. And I think that the law of mentalism really addresses that very beautifully because it basically suggests that if we're willing to buy it, yes, that we and again, I think the mystical traditions would corroborate this. And physics may not say this directly, but I think that there's a large and growing subpopulation among modern physicists who will suggest that, like John Wheeler, for example, who says, there's no out there.
Right.
That's a quote from him, which is basically saying, this is a mentally projected universe.
Yes.
And that, I think, is what totally freaked out, again, the likes of Bohr and Planck and Einstein and Heisenberg and all those folks who recognize that, you know, not only is a electron, a wave, or a particle, depending on how you set up your experiment and when your expectations.
Right.
But also, you know, you can take, for example, the paired electron phenomena, where you take two pairs of electrons, and if you change the spin on one, the spin on its partner will change instantaneously, not at the speed of sound, or even the speed of light, or even 100 times the speed of light, or a million times. It's instantaneously.
Yes.
So if that's true, then there either our assumptions about space being, discrete and disconnected are flawed, or there's something funny going on.
Exactly.
So, and I think those are some of the things that started shifting the paradigm of exclusion and duality to one of inclusiveness and the holographic model that really, I think interconnectedness is sort of a training wheel concept for oneness.
Yes.
Because we can't really grok oneness as humans. We can, we can talk the good fight and everything, but when it comes right down to it, we're all pretty clueless about what that really is. But what the metaphysics, I think, of this Hermetic thought system, and then the metaphysics that followed as I was studying the non-dual portions of it, suggests is you can look at these laws, like the law of mentalism, which is everything is mental, the law of correspondence, as above, so below, or if you will, as within, so without. Mm-hmm. If the mystics are true and the ideas in our mind don't really leave their source, then what we're seeing outside of ourselves is a projection of our own awareness.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
That is a very sobering realization when we see things that we're not, that are not quote unquote to our liking.
Absolutely, it is.
And if we want to have a good vibration station in our mind, what we need to do is to work on the vibrations, if you will, the third law of the three Hermetic laws, the third of the seven Hermetic laws, rather, is the law of vibration, which is everything vibrates, everything has a vibratory frequency or pattern associated with it. And if we think in terms of really simply, there's really only two thought systems. There's the thought system of inclusion and a thought system of exclusion.
Yes.
And within that, and we can start with these first three laws. If we use the mind for bringing together or integrating or making whole or seeing the sameness, not necessarily in the level of form or manifestation, but in the level of the mind, that's where we recognize our kinship, and that's where we feel the harmony and the oneness and the relatedness to not just hand-picked, cherry-picked, selected portions of the cosmos,
yes,
including our own households, our own communities and planet, but we're forced, nobody can force it, we have to come to this conclusion ourselves, but if we look at the true logic behind it, not only the modern physics but also the mystical traditions suggest that everything really is part of the same cosmic flux, the same stuff.
Yes.
And if we're all the same stuff, then shooting anything is shooting yourself in the foot.
Exactly. That.
So I mean, and obviously we can get this in sort of a moralistic kind of form of the golden rule and all this sort of thing.
Absolutely.
But if there's no other, if John Wheeler is right, if there's no out there, then any condemnation or any judgment we make, it's not talking about giving up common sense or the ability to discriminate, shapes and colors and doing all the normal things we do in our life, but just to, on an internal level, if we see ourselves as different from other people, on a fundamental level, and that I think is the root of any kind of war or conflict, and that's where if we really want to find lasting peace, we need to really take a serious look at that in order to have a good time vibration.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
and to see the correspondence and align our vibratory awareness to that principle that everything is really interconnected. And absolutely. I'll just go through the other four laws real quickly, because I know I can see we're about out of time.
No. I'd love to hear the four laws.
Yeah, the fourth one is polarity, which is basically everything has opposites. And again, within the dualistic system of our space-time continuum, that's completely true.
Wow.
But I think we can use the polarizations and our awareness of the opposites to bring us to an awareness that in truth, what we are in essence is all the same.
Yes.
I mean, there's myriads of form. I mean, our senses are incredibly convincing. I mean, it's like the special effects houses of the movie studios of the world have nothing on our imaginations.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true.
Because, I mean, we've created a universe with our minds that is so convincing and is so photorealistic, to use a technical term.
It's so true.
We've bought into it hook, line, and sinker, and we think this is the real deal.
Yep.
I mean, and it would be silly, obviously, to not do the things that you know, benefit our bodies and our families.
Absolutely.
And our communities and our world.
Absolutely.
And to do, you know, politically and environmentally conscious things that help people live a kinder, more humane and more benevolent life.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, if we can look at the things that we do that keep us polarized, which is really, again, back to the first law, the law of mentalism, whenever we find ourselves in a we-they paradigm, we're using the law of polarity against ourselves.
Yep.
and obviously indirectly against everyone else, and furthering the conflict that exists only in our mind.
Yes.
So and then the other three of these seven laws is the law of rhythm. Which and each of these has a geometric symbol, which I go into in the geometry code.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
And because we'll I think it fits very nicely with some of the geometric archetypes. And so a spiral works really nicely for the law of rhythm. If you think of ourselves as not just rotating around and around and ad infinitum. One of my colleagues, Nassim Haramein, who you might be familiar with, has some nice little animations. I just saw one of his on, I think it was on Facebook, over the weekend, of showing how we're not just going over and over the same thing. We're actually spiraling through space.
Yes,
we're on a helical path, just like the DNA molecule ourselves.
Exactly.
We're going through, and rather than covering the same turf, we actually have an opportunity to, each time we forgive ourselves for believing in duality, each time we let go of our emotional attachment to differences and victimhood and vengeance and grievances, that thought system of separation and duality is undone by that much.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And then the law of cause and effect, which is the next one, which is a crucial law, which basically suggests that the mind is causal, and the material world that we see around us, this incredible, very convincing, extremely popular hologram, it's a fabrication. It's made up.
Yes.
And that's what physics and metaphysics, I think, tell us.
A big projection.
And then last but not least is gender generation, which basically suggests that there's a yin and a yang, a masculine and feminine aspect to everything. But everything generates according to its kind. So the thoughts of inclusion continue to generate along their nature.
Right.
And, the seed is – the tree is like the seed that it came from.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That principle is irrevocable. And so the thoughts of discord, the thoughts that suggest that we're fundamentally different in essence – which are bogus, they continue to generate that kind of confusion in our thoughts and the manifestations that follow that.
So. Wow. That's absolutely, I mean, that's literally everything that, we talk about here on the Vibration Station, that, everything that you are experiencing is a projection of your vibrational output, right? And,
yes.
To sum it up, it's basically, you get what you give, but not only on the level of, if you, if you're nice to someone, they'll be nice to you. Literally on a universal, fundamental platonic level of like you, what you emit, you are asking for, right? You are literally saying to the universe in which you are not only a part of, but you are. So it's like, I love this quote. It's, you're not one drop in an entire ocean. You're the entire ocean in one drop, right?
Exactly.
So it's that kind of idea. And Bruce, one thing that I wanted to say, which kind of for me, when I heard this, really summed up for me the understanding of, you know, the difference in individuality and separation, but at the same time, us all still being one, is the only thing that gives the illusion of separation is the difference in vibration.
Yes.
Meaning that if you and I, Bruce, were to literally, on our consciousness, if we were to literally be vibrating at the exact same frequency, we would be one. There would not be a difference between you and I. We would no longer be Bruce and David. We would be Braved.
Sure. You know? Yeah, exactly. And, yes. And even using that, you know, as a geometric metaphor, an archetype, you could think of the circle that, if anybody's taken a course in trigonometry, really is the origin of the sine wave and the cosine wave that basically are the archetypes for vibration.
Yes.
This circle is what's common to every vibration.
Absolutely.
Just as that perfect whole complete unity that the circle or sphere represents is the intrinsic oneness that, if that radius is expanded to infinity, encompasses all.
Yes.
That's our essence, and we all share that same essence.
That is,
and I know we have what, 5, 10 or 5 minutes left, or we have completely out of time.
You know what, Bruce? We are at 150, my friend. We are pulling up to the very conclusion of our episode.
And we didn't talk about Platonic solids and the Plato's allegory of the cave and countless other things. So
we have yet to touch on this. But you know we're just going to have you on many more shows, Bruce, and spread your knowledge. That's what we're just going to do.
Sounds good.
Because we love you, man. We love everything that you say and everything that you have to offer, Bruce. I can't thank you enough for coming here on the Vibration Station and sharing your amazing knowledge, your amazing experiences. And listeners, definitely prepare yourself to hear a lot more of Bruce Rawls over here on the Vibration Station.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, Bruce. And I just want to let all you guys know, you can make sure to pick up the Geometry Code on geometrycode.com. Make sure to also check out Bruce Rawls. That's BRUCERAWLES.com. geometrycode.com. We love you guys. Always sending unconditional love, light, happiness, joy, and laughter from our hearts to yours. Once again, Bruce, thank you so much. We love you, my friend. And be listening up for Bruce Rawls here on the Vibration Station. We love you guys so much. We'll see you next Sunday. Bye-bye.
When we used to chill at Long's, get drunk and blaze, but I guess that was just another phase, like selling X or getting late. But now I have to work to get paid. Not that money really matters in this life, I mean, right? Not that money really matters in this life. Not that money really matters in this life. Not that money really matters in this life.